Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama at the White House today talking about Afghanistan, talking about drawdowns and headcounts and timelines. Here you go.
Yeah, this is how wars end in the 21st century.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 27th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. The calendar was on the president's mind today as he took to the Rose Garden to make some remarks on Afghanistan. In a nutshell, it goes like this. Combat operations over by the end of this year. 9,800 Americans still on the ground come New Year's. Half that many by the end of 2015. And just, and I'm quoting here, a normal embassy presence by the end of 2016. Janine Davidson is a senior fellow in defense policy studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Is this decision today, the president basically saying, we're going to pack it up and go home and take all our money out and you guys are going to have to do it yourselves?
Well, I wouldn't phrase it that way. You know, these sorts of interventions, as the president actually said, this is how wars end in the 21st century. We, as the intervening country, do not necessarily completely finish the job for the next decades upon decades. The mission for the intervening force is to get the host nation to a point where they can take over the security themselves. And as the president said, Afghanistan will never be perfect. There will always be violence there. So the whole mission is about enabling them to be able to do it themselves.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, we originally went into Afghanistan in order to rout al-Qaeda. So right. there's going to be a continuing mission in order to do that. But in addition, in order to for us to be able to leave, Afghanistan has got to be able to take up the trajectory that we've set. In order to do that, we may be able to take the troops out, but they'll continue to need some economic assistance.
How are we going to know? What are you going to look for as a person who analyzes this stuff in 18 months to know whether the environment is safe for economic assistance, whether things are deteriorating? What are you going to be looking at?
I think the most important thing right now is the health and the competency of the Afghan security forces. I'm actually fairly optimistic based on what the commanders on the ground have said. They've made amazing strides in the last 4 years. The fact that they take on 95%+ of the tactical operations without U.S. assistance is huge. The issue going forward is their institutional capacity to maintain the forces. You know, mundane things like payroll and training.
And other things like logistics and supply, which the Americans typically do in great numbers, right? They bring in helicopters, they fly stuff all around the country. Afghans can't do that anymore, can they?
There are ambitions to train them as well to do those sorts of things. And I think that is the focus, that should be the focus of the next year going forward.
If this works out for the president, as he sees it happening, by the end of 2016, we will be out mostly of Iraq, we will be out mostly of Afghanistan. And yet, nobody's talking peace dividend, nobody's talking, oh, this will free up some room in the Pentagon budget.
You know, what people don't understand is that the Pentagon budget, which is something like $500 billion, is the base budget. That's what we use to organize, train, and equip and be ready. That is not the money we use to fight. When we have to go to war, we have to ask for more money. We won't have to be funding that going forward. But I think a lot of people don't understand that those are very separate things.
Yeah, and we won't have to be borrowing it fundamentally, right? I mean,
well, you never know what the future holds. Nobody thought we were going to be in a war in Afghanistan in the year 2000. Nobody thought we were going to be in Iraq, and certainly not for 12 to 13 years. So we never know what tomorrow's going to hold. And that's why the military has to be organized, trained, and ready, but not necessarily deployed.
Janine Davidson is a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Janine, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, pretty decent all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We turn now to the protein wars. Pilgrim's Pride, the world's second biggest purveyor of prime poultry, wants to get into the sausage business. It's made a $6.5 billion bid for Hillshire Brands, better known for its lunch meats and Jimmy Dean sausages. Sally Herships has that story.
Would you like the chicken or the pork? That's the question Pilgrim's Pride wants to ask.
When you call on a retail client, you want to give them as broad a choice of products as possible.
John Stanton teaches food marketing at St. Joseph's University. He says Pilgrim's Pride is mainly a poultry producer, so it's planned by a company that sells pork. Hillshire Farms makes sense.
You want to say, you don't need to talk to sausage people. You don't need to talk to pork people, because when you talk to me, I can sell you all your poultry and all your pork products you want.
But chicken and pork are both commodities. Their prices are not very flexible. That's according to Rob Campanino. He's with Sector and Sovereign Research.
So the price of chicken goes up and down, but that's solely determined by the cost to produce it.
Like the cost of chicken feed. So Campanino says Pilgrim Pride's bid isn't just about gaining the ability to sell more kinds of protein. It's about moving beyond commodities and getting into brands like Jimmy Dean Sausages, which is owned by Hillshire Farms.
So what you can do with something like Jimmy Dean is you can innovate, you can raise prices. And when you raise these prices, they're price increases that aren't necessarily driven solely by changes in what it costs you to make it.
Campanino says consolidating the two companies would also offer some savings, but that's not the meat of the deal. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You're going to hear a lot in the next couple of days about carbon dioxide, public enemy number one in the climate change wars. Early next week, for the first time, the Environmental Protection Agency is expected to propose rules limiting the carbon dioxide that is produced by the power plants that generate most of the electricity in this country. Marketplace's Dan Weissman tells us what to look for in that.
Previous EPA rules have hit existing coal-burning plants by focusing on pollutants like mercury and sulfur dioxide that older coal plants produce. Pending rules would limit carbon dioxide pollution from new power plants and factories.
The rule that the EPA is going to propose next week is the first step that's really aimed specifically at the power sector, reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector.
That's Jonas Monast from Duke University. The administration will create carbon reduction targets for states and allow each state to make a plan for hitting its target. One of the most efficient ways to hit a target, shut down older, heavily polluting coal-burning plants. This isn't exactly war on coal. Ted Nordhaus runs a group called the Breakthrough Institute.
The real war on coal is not being waged by the administration. It's being waged by cheap natural gas.
Coal's biggest advantage as a power source has been it's cheap. Low natural gas prices have eaten away much of that advantage. Utilities have been shutting down older coal plants and opening up new gas plants that also pollute less.
This is the crown jewel of the Obama administration's climate policy.
Regulations can lock in that shift and extend it, says Kevin Book with Clearview Energy Partners. Adding next week's proposals to what we've already seen could mean the U.S. ends up getting about a third less energy from coal than it did a few years ago. How much carbon emissions will be reduced depends on the target they set.
If you have a price on carbon, then you have the ability to tax countries that don't.
That is, you put import taxes on goods produced by carbon-polluting countries. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
If you live here in Southern California, or really pretty much any place in the country, your kid at some point is going to want you to take him or her to Disneyland. Tough though it may be to imagine now, the park that gave rise to Euro Disney and Shanghai Disney and Hong Kong Disney, not to mention much of greater Orlando, Florida, was at one point not much more than a pitch to investors. Not just an amusement park, but oh, so much more. Cory Doctorow from the website Boing Boing got his hands on the original Disney prospectus not too long ago. Cory, it's good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
This is kind of an extraordinary document. Six, maybe seven pages laying out, in a way, Disneyland as we know it today.
Yeah, well, Disneyland, as we can see how it became it today, I think,
right,
is the more interesting piece.
It's
not the similarities. It's really the differences that are kind of exciting.
Well, lay out a couple of those. What struck you when you got your hands on this thing?
Well, I guess the big one is just how much Disneyland back then was a kind of predecessor to the shopping mall, how recreational shopping was very much anticipated by Walt. And basically what he wanted to do was make a place where you could come, where you could get the kind of things that you had to be a very sophisticated person indeed to get in 1953 post-war America, things that would literally not be on sale anywhere else in the world, that would be sort of hand-picked by him from all over, for a long time before they went to an all-you-can-eat ticket that lets you ride all the rides, you could buy a ticket that was just good for admission. And when you went in, you could just go shop. And it was quite the done thing in Los Angeles to go and do your Christmas shopping there.
That strikes me as inconceivable today to actually schlep down to Anaheim to go shopping.
Yeah, it's quite a long way. Although Walt had quite an amazing vision for the kinds of things you'd be able to buy down there. It wasn't just that he wanted to sell you tropical fish and even tropical birds. He wanted to sell you miniature ponies.
As in live miniature ponies?
As in live miniature ponies.
Wow. There was a bunch of other stuff in here that sort of became this thing we know today. For example, out in Tomorrowland, the idea of corporate sponsors. I mean, Walt didn't have a whole lot of money to plow into this thing, and he gets Kaiser Aluminum to sponsor big exhibits in Tomorrowland.
Yeah, although the best of those definitely was the dairy of the future sponsored by the Dairy Farmers of America, where they just had papier-mâché cows that had IVs stuck in their hocks and huge video screens of pastures that they could sit and watch while they sort of contemplated life indoors. It's actually kind of interesting, given that this was also the dawn of things like cubicles and the Levittowns and so on, that really they were saying, well, we figured out a way to make humans who previously toiled in the fields happy working indoors. Maybe we could do the same for our cows.
What do you think Walt does if he comes back to Disneyland today, based on this document from 60 years ago?
Oh, no, I think he'd be delighted. I actually think that... He would look around Disney and see that despite the extraordinary incursions that have been made at various times by the bean counting Roy people, Roy being his brother,
Roy Disney, the financial guy,
the money strings. There's no way you could justify to a shareholder putting on that little bit of gold plating, that little bit of plussing up, as Walt used to say. And that ethos is very much alive. And I think that really the only description that you can make for things that people do because they're aesthetically pleasing, even though there's no rational return on the investment, the only real definition for that is art. And I think that the park is still the domain of people who think of themselves as artists and of the park as a work of art. And that's why it was such a pleasure to publish this.
Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing. Cory, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, here's the thing about modern art.
Spend 5 minutes looking at the artwork, and you spend 25 minutes being told the backstory to the artwork.
It's all about the story, people. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 69 points today, 0.4%, closed at 16,675, did the blue chips. The Nasdaq soared 51 points. That's more than 1.2%, finished at 4,237. The S&P 500 up 11.6%. Ended things at 1911. Bank of America-led financials rang up a 3.3% gain after the bank said it has given the Federal Reserve a new, smaller, and, oh yeah, more accurate capital plan. The poultry producer Pilgrim's Pride, we were talking about that up at the top, flew up 1.3% today after it offered to buy the packaged food company Hillshire Brands. Hillshire traded up 22%. That deal in turn could derail Hillshire's plans to buy Pinnacle Foods, which owns brands like Duncan Hines. Pinnacle down more than 5% today. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.51%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to be in West Point, New York, to deliver the commencement address to the U.S. Military Academy's class of 2014. Shoe company DSW releases quarterly earnings. And author Ian Fleming was born on May 28, 1908. You're probably familiar with one of his very charismatic characters, James Bond. I'm Philippi, Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Zappos, the online shoe company, is a growing enterprise. And when companies grow, they need more people, which means Zappos spends a lot of time hiring. But if you swing by its jobs page today, you will notice a distinct lack of job postings. The company now says if you want to work there, you're going to have to join its social network. And once you're friends, they will consider you for openings. And it turns out a lot of other companies, a lot of them in high tech, aren't satisfied with the traditional process of job postings, resumes, and interviews either. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on how hiring is changing.
A lot of the creative hiring we hear about is in tech companies. Stanford management professor Bob Sutton says one reason is programmers are really hard to find.
It's very competitive. So the reason you would do something that's a little bit weird would be to attract people to your company and to have you stand out.
Tech companies also like to use puzzles and brain teasers in recruiting and interviewing. That gives them a look into what the applicant can do, but also speaks to another challenge, says Northwestern University management professor Nicholas Pierce.
One of the biggest issues that companies are facing currently is not just attracting talent that is competent, but attracting talent that fits the culture of their organization.
And this isn't just touchy-feely stuff. Losing somebody because they don't fit in hurts profits.
Oh, the cost of a bad hire is huge.
Steve Miranda is managing director of Cornell's Center for Advanced Human Resource Studies.
Typically, that runs anywhere from 50 to 200% of what the person's actual salary is.
Managers don't want to throw that kind of money away. And it's not just tech firms trying new things. Sutton says companies of all kinds are using better data in hiring. It's telling them to throw away the old playbooks that worship resumes and interviews.
They're starting to use employee selection methods that are actually based on research rather than the mythology that's been around forever.
That's not to say resumes and interviews are dead, but if that's all you do, some great jobs will be off limits. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The phrase healthcare reform kind of assumes doing new things, right? Better and different things. But try this for another kind of reform. Doctors making house calls. I know it's not Thursday, but it is kind of a throwback. Eric Drachman has the story.
Hello, it's Dr. Farzam.
Dr. Michael Farzam is CEO of House Call Doctor Los Angeles.
Yes, I remember. How's she doing?
He's been seeing patients in their homes for 13 years.
I can do everything in the home essentially a doctor's office or a typical urgent care can do. So we do x-rays and ultrasounds. We administer IV fluids.
And some cases can only be solved by a home visit, like the time he diagnosed a whole family with carbon monoxide poisoning from an old furnace.
It's just something you had to see visually in the home to be able to make that diagnosis. You know, if they had been in that house one more night, they probably all would have died. And that was a nice day. That makes the job very worthwhile.
It's this personal care and the access his patients have that make them so satisfied.
Great. And you have my cell phone, so if you have any questions, call me anytime. Okay, bye-bye.
Did you catch that? His patient has his cell phone number and can call anytime. So this kind of service must be for the super wealthy, right? At around $400 a visit, Dr. Farzam says he does see the 1% here in L.A., corporate executives and celebrities who want the privacy and convenience.
But I'd say 95% of my patients are middle-income people who hold average jobs, and any way you look at it, our fee is less expensive than an emergency room visit, even if you have good insurance.
Sam Zabarjadi is trying to make sure that house call visits are for everyone. He's CEO of a tech startup called Medicast. The model is like Uber for healthcare. Patients can hail a doctor 24/7 from a mobile app.
It's really as simple as just clicking a button when you're not feeling well, and we find a nearby on-call doctor who will come to your home, your office, or hotel in under 2 hours.
Medicast has been up and running in Miami for almost a year, and it launches in Los Angeles next week. Of course, there was a reason house calls all but disappeared in the middle of last century. Medicine became more expensive. Having medical insurance became necessary, and dealing with that ate into doctors' profits.
About 60 to 70% of the costs of healthcare are really in the overhead that come with traditional practices.
To make up for all that overhead, Zabarjadi says doctors might have to see 30 patients a day.
And they spend about 6 to 8 minutes per patient. So it's a very stressful experience.
The Medicast model is a twist on a relatively new trend. It's called private medicine, and it's growing by 25% a year. The idea is eliminate some of the costs associated with billing insurance. That way, doctors can afford to spend more time with patients. So these house call practices are a cash business. They don't take insurance. They also don't need nurses, receptionists. They don't even need the office. But still, these are doctors driving to your homes. How do the non-millionaire patients afford that? Zabarjadi says people are saving money on insurance by choosing policies with high deductibles.
A lot of people are using healthcare for catastrophic events and actually looking elsewhere to services like ours for basic wellness and urgent care needs.
So when you go to sleep with a high deductible insurance plan and wake up in the middle of the night with an alarming fever, you're faced with a choice. A potential $3,000 in the emergency room or $400 or so for a home visit. That house call might just be the frugal choice, as well as a lot more restful. In Los Angeles, I'm Eric Drachman for Marketplace.
Earlier this month, Sotheby's and Christie's, the two biggest auction houses, sold off nearly $1 billion worth of contemporary art between them, with individual pieces going for tens of millions of dollars. Pieces that, when you look at them, you sometimes say, $75 million for that? Seriously? Don Thompson is here to explain why art goes for as much as it does, at least insofar as is knowable. His new book is called The Supermodel and the Brillo Box, Backstories and Peculiar Economics from the World of Fine Art. Don, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Why do we care about the art market? We're talking the top 1% of the 1% of the 1% here.
That's exactly right. We're looking at art that sells for $3 or $5 million and up at a major contemporary art auction. It's a parallel universe, Kai, and that's the best way you can describe it. I found it fascinating. The people are fascinating. The process is fascinating. And the way that art is sold based on the backstory to the piece. A simple example, many of your listeners will have had the experience of somebody buying a piece of art and inviting them over. You say, come and have a drink and see my new artwork. And you spend 5 minutes looking at the artwork, and you spend 25 minutes being told the backstory to the artwork.
Is that why you maintain in this book that art galleries aren't really just for looking around? I mean, they're for a more substantive purpose than that? I mean, it's fun to go into them and look around, but I'm never going to buy any of this stuff.
Oh, no. People like you and me that go to auctions and don't buy anything and go to galleries and don't buy anything are the audience, and we're the audience that proves this is a really important production. If you think of an auction room with only 6 people in it, or a gallery where only serious buyers come in. So the rest of us are the audience, and we get to see a free show that sometimes is pretty interesting.
Just as there is a backstory to the works of art in this book, so too is there a backstory on the economics of these auction houses, how they get the works, what they pay to get the works, the guarantees. It is, Byzantine is kind of a kind word.
Well, it's an evolved structure, and it really just involves Sotheby's and Christie's and their competition. What's interesting is that every duopoly in the world that you can think of, MasterCard and Visa, Coke and Pepsi, manage to compete with each other without cutting prices dramatically. The single exception to that economic duopoly model are the auction houses, who discount consignors' commissions, who give buyers premiums, some of them back to consignors, to get the star works of art that appear in the catalog and that they think attract people to auctions.
You point out that contained in the word contemporary for contemporary art is also the word temporary. It's very ephemeral, right? The prices and the auctions and the this and the that of this whole thing.
Most of the art that we write about and admire today will disappear from public view in 20 years. If you go back to the 1990s and look at major art magazines or look at auction catalogs, 50% of the work that was being sold in the early 90s in major Sotheby's and Christie's catalogs is no longer offered in major evening auctions. But artists go out of fashion.
Huh.
Schools of art go out of fashion. What seems very new and in today is not new and in 5 years from now. And some artists evolve and some don't evolve. Being a professional artist is one of the 3 or 4 worst professions in the world.
At least while you're still alive, right?
Well, the idea that death raises the value of your work works for only a very few branded name artists because suddenly there's a shortage factor because there won't be any more. It doesn't work for 95% of artists.
Do you dabble in the art market yourself?
I don't dabble in it as an investment. I buy work that I love and want to live with, and I don't care if it goes up in value.
That's the way to do it. Don Thompson is an economist by training. He writes about the art market and does so specifically in a new book called The Supermodel and the Brillo Box, Backstories and Peculiar Economics from the World of Contemporary Art. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a plug of sorts. Well, more like an outright plug, truth be told. If you want to hear our stories when you're not near your radio, boy, have we got a deal for you. We have rebuilt the Marketplace app for Android, iPhone, and iPad. Build yourself custom playlists and then carry them around with you wherever you can go. You can find the link at our website. It's marketplace.org, or you can search for Marketplace APM in your app store of choice. And with that, the radio show, Marketplace from APM, is done for today. The Dow is up at 69 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 51 points, more than 1.2%. The S&P 500 put on 11 points. That is 0.6%. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.